Good morning, diners and travelers in pursuit of the good life. We're going to take you with us to London, where we go every year, and we had a wonderful time again this year.
Yeah, how does it go, Pussycat? Pussycat, where have you been? I've been up to London to see the Queen.
Well, we didn't see the Queen.
Well, we did go see some of her pictures.
We did.
But apropos, we also investigated a new event for us that's been going on for 75 years, all about art and antiques. So if you're an art and antique person, listen up while Howard Hartley of the
Grosvenor
House Hotel talks about the Art and Antiques Fair, which is in June, and perhaps you'll be interested in going. After you've talked to Howard, I'm sure you will be.
We come back to the Grosvenor House frequently because it's such a wonderful place to stay. But one of the reasons that we come is because Howard Hartley, the senior sales manager, is such a really wonderful host. And he always has something new to talk to us about. But he failed the test just now because it turns out that last night on the menu was staying at the Grosvenor House when 1,900 of the world's finest people in the film and television business gathered here for dinner after the BAFTA Awards, which are the British equivalent of the Oscars. And everyone was there, and we didn't see any of them. And not only that, Howard won't tell us where they were, because he's a good hotelier, so he's really not allowed to do that. But those of you who like the wonderful new movie Slumdog Millionaire will be jealous to know that we met a number of people from the Bollywood crew around the halls. They were relatively easy to spot. But that's not the reason we checked by, because the Grosvenor House has been suffering through, I think one would almost say, a very long and very careful renovation. And Howard, we're at the last step, right?
We are, yes. It's, as you say, it has been a very long process. We've been renovating the hotel over the past 4 years. The bill at present stands at about £120 million. And
a little cost overrun there.
Yeah, always. We were hoping to spend less than £100 million, but just over £120 million. We've got our spa to complete now. And then we're completely finished. The spa should be back in the middle of this year, so June, July of this year. But all of the hotels, rooms, public areas, restaurants, meeting facilities and banqueting facilities are all now complete.
And the neat part about it is that the lobby looks the same as it did in the 1950s and 1960s when I used to come here.
Absolutely. I think maintaining the traditions has always been key to the success of the program. We try to keep as many of the original features as possible and work around them. We are a Grade 2 listed building, so we can't touch the exterior of the hotel, but we still wanted to maintain that English manor house feel.
And it absolutely has that feel. It's a little bit hard to determine just exactly where the front desk is. But once you get your bearings, you know the concierge desk must be opposite, and sure enough, that's where it is. All of the dining facilities are there, including Richard Corrigan's Mayfair,
yep,
which you enter from the street to the north of the building, but
it's
now a space that's filled. So listen, this is just a great place to be. It's so convenient, and everyone's so careful and thoughtful. So the service is the hallmark, I think, of what's going on. But the reason that we're talking to Howard more than anything else today is he told us about an event which can hardly be considered a new event since it's its 75th anniversary this year, but it's the first time we heard about it. Howard, tell us about the Art and Antiques Fair.
Grosvenor House Art and Antiques Fair, as you say, celebrating its 75th anniversary. We held the first Grosvenor House Art and Antiques Fair in 1934, and there's only been 2 years where the show was suspended, and that was during 1944 and 1945. But apart from that, every year we've had an Art and Antiques Fair. It has royal patronage, and the patron at the moment is Princess Alexandra. And we have a gala event which takes place for the first night of the fair, which is the 11th of June.
Let's plug those dates in right away. It's June 11th.
June the 11th through to the 17th.
So if you're in the art and antiques loving business, even if you don't buy anything, you sort of have to come to see what's on display.
It definitely, in the UK, is the leading art and antiques fair and known as one of the best four in the world. I suppose the thing that makes it very unique is that each piece has to be for sale and it's vetted for authenticity. So you guarantee buying the real article.
But the catalog looks like the catalog book for a fine art exhibition at the National Gallery or at the Metropolitan Museum of Art or somewhere like that.
Yeah, it's a 300-page hard copy book which depicts every piece that's on show. And really, they're collector's items within themselves. If you go on eBay, you'll find Grosvenor House Art and Antiques Fair catalogues dating back from the 30s, 40s, all the way through to present day.
And the catalogue for the 2009 show comes out in...
Comes out in March. Yeah, it's we've just filled the last stall, so we've sold the last of the units, and then the dealers will then say what they're going to be showing. We'll get those photographed, because it's all in colour.
Fortunately for On the Menu's budget, Annie's looking at a catalogue right now, but it's a catalogue of items that were already sold last year.
Yeah. Good for your pocket.
But, yeah, but she's really looking at some real masterpieces, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm wondering if you have to get the dealers to sign up for this book that far in advance, what happens if they have a buyer for one of these pieces?
Well, I mean, there are other pieces they sell. I mean, these are examples of what they...
Okay, so this is not guaranteed. When you buy the book, it's not a guarantee you can...
No, but...
I mean, the stuff is breathtaking. Of all the many things you can buy at these various art and antique shows, I mean, this stuff is creme de la creme. Yeah, absolutely.
And it covers multi-mediums as well. I mean, you've got 5,000 BC to present day. You also have wines, photography, furniture, works of art on canvas, lithographs. It covers multimediums.
Now, this all takes place, I'm guessing the exhibit takes place in the Great Room.
It does, yeah. It takes place in the Great Room. The exhibition takes a week to set up and a week to break down. But really, what we try to create are individual shops, and there are more than 70 shops which are available for people to go through.
And if people are wanting to stay at the Grosvenor House while they come to the fair, how far in advance should they book, or is it already too late?
No, it's not too late. It is a popular time of the year, and rooms certainly go fairly quickly. A lot of the dealers are international, so they come over and they stay overnight. But we have special packages for the Art and Antiques Fair.
Great. Now, what's the best way for people to find out about those, Howard?
Well, you can two ways. You can go on to our website, which is www.londongrosvenorhouse.co.uk, or you can go on to the fair's website, which has an automatic link into our own website, which is www.grosvenorfair.co.uk.
So this is a wonderful time to be in England. It will still be spring. Perhaps it won't be raining. It won't be quite as cold as it is right now.
Yeah.
It's a relatively comfortable place. If you're in the art and antiques business, or if you're just interested in looking at art and antiques, it seems like a pretty unique opportunity to see a lot of things gathered together in one place. So I'm going to find it hard to convince Anne that she shouldn't come.
That was my next question. I wanted to ask, do these things go for... This is all museum quality art and antiques. Are the prices museum quality as well?
Some. Alison Vassier, who runs the fair for us, has done for many years, always tells me that there are items under £200. I've yet to find an item under £200, but apparently they are available. But yes, they are hundreds of thousands, and in some cases millions.
But you can get bargains.
You can get bargains. And of course, they're all shopkeepers and they're all barterers, so I'm sure that there are bargains to be had.
Well, Howard, you've always got something new for us, and we thank you once again for bringing news of an exciting adventure for On the Menu listeners. Thank you so much for joining us. It's a pleasure to meet you again, to stay at your wonderful hotel.
And it's great to have you back. It's always nice to see you and Anne, and always home from home for you whenever you come to London.
Well, and continuing along our old home theme, we're going to be visiting another old friend, Chef Claude Bossy of Hibiscus, and listen to what he has to say. Back in the day, maybe like 3 years ago, I think, but you can correct me on that, OTM On the Menu had to drive 2.5 hours to have lunch at Hibiscus. Now, here we are in London, we're talking to the chef who has made this gigantic move, Claude Bossy. Welcomed On the Menu again, because you've talked to us before.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and we just had lunch here, and it was much easier getting here than driving to Ludlow, which is a very small village, if I'm correct, although it's a rather particular one. But you were there for how many years in Ludlow?
I was altogether nearly 10 years in Ludlow.
All of a sudden, here you are now in the big city. You're in London. We had talked about how wonderful it was being in the country. What made you decide then to stop that, move your whole operation at great risk into the big city, into London?
I would say I needed a challenge. You know, like I said, early 10 years in Ludlow, after a while, you could get bored.
Yeah, it's very small.
That's it, 9,000 people, you know. I've been having hibiscus now for 7 years. 10 years I've been working before in Ludlow, but 7 years with hibiscus. And you know, when you start waking up in the morning and you feel like you're doing the same thing every day, you're getting bored, and I needed a new challenge. So I said, okay, I spoke to Claire, my wife, about it. And at the time, we have Paige, who was very young. Like we said, if we want to do it, we have to do it now. Not Paige will start going to school and it's going to be too difficult.
That's your daughter, Paige.
That's
yes.
It, yeah.
And beautiful, beautiful little girl.
Thank you very much. No, that's it. We just say, okay, we need to put the restaurant on the market and just go for it. And I think we sold the restaurant in 6 months.
Aha. Uh-huh.
That's it.
And that was before you actually found a place in London?
Yeah, I didn't find the place. I sold the because everybody told me it will take you ages to sell a 2-Michelin-star restaurant in the countryside. Nobody in the right mind will buy it. I said, okay, well, we have to put it on the market and see how you go. And I've got somebody who was interesting. And in 6 months later, we sold it.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't miss the opportunity to sell the restaurant because I don't know if it was going to happen again. So I said, okay, come on, we do it. We sell it and we see how you go. And we find hibiscus. We sold hibiscus in April and I was in London in October.
Wow. Now, of course, I had to comment on the fact that the ambience, the decor of this restaurant is very different from your small-town restaurant, actually. It's much more sophisticated, I think, in your decor here.
Ludlow was a listing building. It was a 15th century. Donc, some part was from the 15th century, some other part from the 17th century. Donc, a lot of character, but like you said,
rustic.
Yeah, a bit more rustic, a bit more dark, a lot of wood as well. Donc, we wanted to bring back the same feeling in London, but a bit more modern. Don't keep the wood, we keep the stone. We got some picture back we saw from Ludlow and try to bring that to London. We are in London now, cosmopolitan, you know, you got people from everywhere in the world.
Yes, you said, though, that your clientele is different because it's the kind of customer you had on weekends in Ludlow.
That's it. The advantage we've got here, we've got roughly the same customer, but in Ludlow we used to have them on a Friday night, Saturday. Here we've got them from Monday to Saturday. You know, they are the everyday customer. Donc you make your life so much easier.
Now, you said that your food actually didn't change that much.
No. No, because hibiscus 7 year old, you do what you do every day. Donc you involve in your style of cooking, but after your philosophy behind the food still says the same. You can't just wake up one morning and decide to change your style. You know, you have to do what you know how to do it.
Why do you think it was? I mean, you gave up a restaurant with 2 stars, but you've got 2 stars again, huh?
Yes.
So how do you think that went? I mean,
it was a hard year. We have a very hard year. I'm so lucky. I've got a great team with me. Uh-huh. And Claire is still involved in the restaurant, but I've got a really good restaurant manager, a really good sommelier. And the rest
now,
of the
did you
team.
Bring them with you or hire them here?
The sommelier was there up to January, was the same I used to have in Ludlow. Donc, he knew my style of food, he knew how I used to work. Damien, my restaurant manager, has been with me now for 7-8 months. Donc, the same. I worked at the Fat Duck for 3 years. Donc, really knew the idea I wanted to bring through the food and the philosophy in the restaurant. And my head chef, Marcus, has been with me for 3 years. Most of the chef de partie was with me for 2 years. Donc, they all knew what we wanted to achieve. And when last January we found out we didn't get back the second time, we just got more anger, just wanted to get it back, and it's been a really tough year. But we really pleased we got it back.
Well, now, talk to us a little bit about your kind of food.
My kind of food. I think you are I'm the wrong person to talk about. I think you are the right person to talk about. We've been eating twice.
Well, of course, we love your food. But it's French-based.
Yes, French tradition, French root. And,
but it's modernized.
Yes, I'm trying. It's not modernized, yes, but I got a problem with that word of modernized because people can think it's gone gimmicky-wise. It's not. It's still food. It's still meat and free veg. You know, that's...
Right.
After you do the way you want to, but on the plate, you still got to meat cook as perfectly as you can, the veg cook as perfectly. And after we try to play with texture, with flavor, but it's still meat at the end, you know, and veg.
Well, no, we had your lunch menu, starting with the Ballantine of foie gras, but it has a little unusual twist. I've never had it served with a salad of a lychee and octopus. And now, did you just make that up, or where did that come from?
Foie gras and seafood is very classic.
Yeah, but octopus?
Why not?
I love it. I mean,
you got people who serve it with oyster. Donc, I thought the octopus would be not as fishy as the oysters, and it would go even better. And the lychee just for the freshness, and is right on season at the moment.
Yeah, and it had like a little gelée, the lychee.
Yes, that was just pure from the lychee. We didn't put anything for it. It was just the normal juice from the lychee.
Very good. And then we had the Welsh rosé veal, stuffed with goat cheese.
Yes, yes,
which was really... the goat cheese is what gave it a gamey taste, because it was really rich and wonderful.
Yes, that's the idea of it. I mean, veal can be quite bland. I mean, I don't think so.
Yeah, I think veal needs a lot of help usually.
Yeah. But, I mean, the English veal, the rosé veal is really full on flavor. But I needed something to bring that flavor of the veal a bit more intense. And the idea is to braise the paupiette. What do you call it, like faggot in this country?
Yeah.
Cook it in a broth. Don't you get all the juice of the flavor of the veal and just intensify it with the goat cheese and a bit of anchovy just to bring the salt in.
Oh, that was the touch, the anchovy.
Yes.
It was wonderful. And then you had the roasted root vegetables. You had the beets.
Yes, you got different beetroot, chervil root, parsley root. You got different color of beetroot, different color of carrots as well. Just what's on season at the moment.
And then I had the roast Cornish pollock with the, what is a grenoblaise sauce?
Grenoblaise,
it has capers.
Capers, lemon, beurre noisette. It's a very classic dish, very classic sauce. And it's been used a lot in France. It's a very, very old tradition. And it's a lovely with fish. And this time of the year, just give you a bit of a kick with not the anchovy, but with the capers, the lemon, and the richness with the brown butter.
And, of course, I mean, when did anybody ever hear me rave about the pilaf? Your pilaf was wonderful with capers.
Yes.
Yeah, you had capers and lemon. What else was in there?
We put a bit of the sauce we use for the fish. Some of the garnish we go back to that pilaf. The pilaf rice is lovely.
It is. It was wonderful.
There's a lot of people who forget about pilaf rice. They must have to do risotto, but a good pilaf, you know, with a good stock and everything is absolutely stunning.
Yes. And then we had two... that they were not super oversweet, which was really good for the desserts. One was the clafoutis with a barley malt ice cream. And then the other one was a caramelized yellow lime tart with clove ice cream. So you make all your ice creams in-house?
Yeah, everything's made. Yeah, we make it 95% of the thing. I've got somebody who's making the bread for us, but everything else is made in-house.
Yeah, and of course I forgot about our egg. We even had a soft poached, soft boiled egg with
palm heart velouté inside of the eggs.
Oh, is that what that is?
Yes, yes, palm heart.
Do you start with fresh palm heart?
Fresh palm heart, yeah. It comes from
really?
Asia, yeah.
Wow, and of course we had our soldier with it.
Ah, yes, to dip it, just to bring you back to breakfast back in memory.
Yeah, like when we were little kids. Well, I mean, it was all very delicious and matched to wines, and I thought the service was extraordinary. Now, how do you find the market in London?
Tough at the moment. I mean, I heard it's very tough in the United
States. Because of the economy in general?
Yes. I mean, you find people... I mean, even if it was full, I think, for lunch today. I think it was nearly full for lunch. No, it was a good lunch for a Monday. But overall, lunch, you can see the people are a bit more careful how they're spending their money. Dinner is different. People who go out on a dinner, I don't think they go worry about the money. But the people who go out for lunch, on business-wise, you can find them a bit careful about how they're spending it.
Hmm. So, basically, your issue with the London audience is because of the general economy, not with the particularities of a London audience?
Oh, no, no. I think it's just a question of the economy. I think that's it. I think everybody's looking around. Everybody's trying to do some deal. And I mean, our lunch is £25. I think we can't go cheaper than that. And I think we do one now with wine and coffee as well for £33. I think it's a great deal. You got fresh produce.
It is a great deal. That's fabulous.
And we're trying to stick to that. And dinner is, what, £60, £65? That's it. It's just, for London, in comparison of Paris or whatever, or even in the United States, New York, I think we are quite cheap in London.
Yeah, you said you're coming to New York, and you have a whole list of restaurants
yes.
that you're going to try.
Yeah, I've got a few friends I want to go see in New York, and I'm really looking forward to
it. Have you been there before?
I've been there 94, 95 it was, ages ago.
Uh-huh. Ages ago, because everything changes there quickly.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
So you're very happy with your move. Everything's running smoothly.
Yeah, I've got the great of both quality. I still got my house in Ludlow, where I can go back home on a weekend. And I got a great job in London where business is good and I love doing what I'm doing here.
Well, we're happy you've moved.
Thank you very much.
Here's Peter.
Now, you have a website, and I don't know if you take reservations over the internet or not.
No, I don't take reservations from the internet. We do have a website with hibiscusrestaurant.co.uk.
And what's ahead? One Michelin star, two Michelin stars?
No,
do you have a goal, or are you just happy where you are?
Two Michelin stars, I'm very happy with where we are at the moment. Now the main thing, I think, for us to get focus is be busy. That's it. Keep the restaurant very busy. I think it should be our main principle. Keep a tight ship to make sure we don't overspend it and everything. And 3-star, I think everybody who's got 2-star wants 3-star. We just have to...
So you definitely... Now, where else do you like to go? Perhaps you don't have the opportunity to go anywhere else in London, but where, if you could, where would you go?
I love Chinese. I love...
We're going to talk about Kai after we go tonight.
Yeah, you say, yeah.
We'll have to let you know and see how we like it.
I'm really looking forward to hear about that, because I heard some really good feedback. I love Chinese food. I love Indian. I love this mix of flavor, like Zuma, Roca, a bit on the Japanese flavor. I love all this thing. For me, it's so different. You know, being French and being training on a French way, it's very important for me to try something different. But I love, you got some great place in London like Arbutus or Wild Honey.
Okay, yes.
And yeah. That's it. It's just honest food. You know, so try anything.
But Wild Honey, you can practically...
Yeah,
you can throw a stone there.
That's it. Yeah. I mean,
if the road was straight, you'd be able to throw a stone through their window.
Yeah, exactly. And Anthony is a great friend of me, man. Okay. He was my best man on my wedding. Look, I love it.
Really?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, I love what he's doing because
he's a lovely guy.
Yes.
And Will is so outgoing and such
exactly.
A great front of house guy.
And they've been both to this style of restaurant like Hibiscus. They've been having partner bridge before. It was brilliant on fine dining, and they just decide to go the way they want to go. And just stick to it, you know. They don't try anything else. They just do honest food and great service, great wine, and they've got a great technique, great formula.
Great. Well, listeners, you can listen to all the aforementioned restaurateurs on the menu through the audio archive, just as if you like. And here's a fun thing to do. It would be to go back to the program in January 2006, where we interviewed Claude for the first time in his restaurant in Ludlow, which has moved, we're delighted to say, intact. Intact, as good as ever. The location is, depending on which way you come, it can be a little hard to find.
Yeah, it is. It's a very small street in between Regent Street and Knoxford Street.
Yeah, the best way, the approach where you'll find it is if you approach from Regent Street and head west on Mannix Street.
That's it.
And it's on the left-hand side. If you're smart like we are, you know that you can come through the alley from Mill Street and the wrist... The road really just doesn't end.
No, it's just... And then Maddox Street is quite long, though. We're really on the beginning of Maddox Street.
So that's how we got here, and you should make your way here, too. And I'm sure you'll have a wonderful time. Claude, thank you so much for talking to us, and please give our regards to Claire. And we're so glad to hear the reports of your success.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming back to us, and look forward to see you again.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. At this point in the show, we always invite you to email us on the menu at onthemenuradio.com or join our blog on themenuradio.blogspot.com. And now let's set up for a grand adventure here. The first time that we've really gone to this restaurant, which just got its first Michelin star.
Pretty exciting thing to talk about, and we had the chance to talk to the owner and founder.
And we had a wonderful, wonderful time.
Then we got to talk to the chef, and he was really excited to talk to us. And finally, we finished up talking to Michael, the sommelier, about the challenges of pairing fine wine with fine but spicy Chinese food.
Yes, this is upscale Chinese, mind you.
So I think you'll find these three interviews back-to-back very interesting, and it's a place that you should definitely put on your list of spots that you want to go to. Kai Mayfair, just around the corner from the Grosvenor House.
Well... Yeah, another absolutely fabulous meal we've had. A restaurant called Kai in Mayfair. In fact, it's called Kai Mayfair, I think. That we're going to be talking to Bernard. We've discussed pronunciation of his name. Bernard would be American. Bernard would be French. But in England, they call it Bernard, and it's Yo. And you've been a delight. Hello.
Hi there.
Tell us a little bit about your background. You were born not in England.
I was born in Malaysia.
So you're not born in China either.
No, I actually haven't been to China before. Until my age of about 15, it was very difficult for people who had a Malaysian passport to go into China. But
you're a lawyer. Now, why did you get hooked in this restaurant business?
I think I was probably hooked to the idea of dealing with food from the time I was about 7-8 years old.
You said your mother cooked 6-course breakfast for your father.
About 6 dishes. She would have at least 6 dishes. She would get out at 5:30 in the morning, and there would be a huge feast downstairs whenever we woke up. I took it for granted. I assumed everybody else in the world did this, but clearly they didn't. And that really got me interested in food generally, but also in the way food was prepared, because my mom would always drop little bits of knowledge about, you know, when you were supposed to put the meat into the wok, how the wok temperatures had to be high. And going to restaurants, I remember restaurants, whenever I could see chefs preparing food, I'd just leave the table and go and stand next to them and ask them lots of questions.
You always loved it. Now, your family was affluent.
Yeah, reasonably affluent.
And how big a family you? Sisters, brothers?
One brother, one sister.
Okay, and you're the only one that caught this food bug.
I think so. I think the rest of them enjoy food very, very much, but not quite to the same extent as I am.
So you came to England and you became a lawyer, or you became a lawyer before you came to England?
Well, I studied to be a lawyer, but when I finally qualified, I realized that this wasn't really the profession for me. It's too much time in libraries.
And you like food.
Yeah, and I remember one of the best memories at university was, you know, in the library telling a friend of mine, let's just go drive down to London for something to eat. The university was about 40 miles away from London. Literally every chance we could get, we would drive down to London, spend all our money on the fuel, you know, and just try and find somewhere to eat.
Amazing. Now, this restaurant, you now have 2 Michelin stars, right? Now,
one Michelin star, yeah.
Well, one Michelin star for a Chinese restaurant in the middle of London is rather amazing. You must have been shocked.
I don't know if we were so much shocked as not sure what to think. And it was more relief than anything. We knew that we had been inspected. We knew on the final inspection that the inspector actually presented a card to us after the meal. She interviewed the chefs. She went into the kitchens. So we knew that we were being considered, but we didn't dare to even think, you know, that of the possibility of getting a star.
How long ago did you... Okay, this was another restaurant before you bought it, right?
That's right.
Give us just a brief history. It was a restaurant that you wanted a restaurant, and then you bought it. Tell us this brief story.
This restaurant, as far as I know, started in, I think, 1978 or 1977. It was actually the first Chinese restaurant in Mayfair. It was owned by 4 or 5 different partners. They opened a restaurant, and it did extremely well. But over the years, I think each partner decided to open their own restaurants, and they, to a certain extent, lost interest in the place. When we took over, the restaurant hadn't been renovated since it was open, and it was a fantastic location. You just don't get a location like this smack in the middle of Mayfair. We're in Mayfair. It's probably one of the most beautiful areas in London. Very historical, a lot of very old buildings. I think most of the buildings around this area must be over 200-300 years old. At least 200 years old. Architecture-wise, it is what London's about. There's a lot of history, and you see lots of plaques on walls, you know, showing... I think Audrey Hepburn actually lived in this building.
Are you sure?
Yes, we found this out last week. We were talking to one of the concierge. He mentioned this. We looked it up on the internet, and there was actually a letter on auction in 2003 written by her to her agent when she was auditioning for Gigi. And it was, the letter had 65 South Audley Street on it.
You're a devil. You never mentioned that. This whole meal, you never mentioned it.
I hope we can get hold of that letter.
That's great. Okay, so you have the... Now, it is absolutely a beautiful restaurant, and you said your wife just did it. She designed it?
The original design was done by somebody else, but about 2 years ago, we wanted to do a renovation, just refresh the restaurant a little. We had a design done by a designer, a full-scale renovation of the restaurant, but that meant that we would have to be closed for close to 2 months, which is a very, very long time to be closed.
For a restaurant, it certainly
absolutely
is.
Absolutely. So we decided that, look, the only way to do it was to do it ourselves. And she has a flair for
sure
design.
Was. I mean, I went to the ladies' room, I said, ooh, this is gorgeous.
The ladies are very important to us. We from day one, we wanted the ladies to have one entire room to each person.
The sink you could take a bath in. Absolutely fabulous.
But I pretty much left the design to her because we had too many arguments and too many, I think it should be like this and she thinks it should be like that. So I decided, look, I'm going to trust you. I'll just let you get on with it.
But you trust a lot of people. You trust your chef to do the stuff he does, which is extraordinary. And then we're going to shortly talk to him. You've created the restaurant of your dreams, I think.
Yes, I mean, it's a dream you had from day one. Little pieces of it are falling into place over the years. You know, every year we sort of, we had an idea of what the restaurant should be from the beginning, but it's materializing. Little bits and pieces here and there. You start seeing the detail in your mind and thinking, oh, actually it should be like this, that the chopsticks should look like this, that the way the menus are laid out should be like this, and that we should have this number of dishes on the menu. And it's a dream which is unfolding all the time. It's not, there is no end to it as such. And I always like to think of it as a work in progress.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what pieces you're most proud of. You just were saying them, little touches that you view as just refinements.
I think the one thing I am particularly proud of is the size of our menu, the number of dishes we have. It when we first opened, it used to be expected that Chinese restaurants had huge menus, and that if you didn't have a huge menu, it would be uncharacteristic of a Chinese restaurant. And we've managed to be able to get customers to accept, to a certain extent, that we have only 40 plus 45 dishes on our menu, or 46 dishes on our menu. And the possibility of a customer ordering something which they're going to have for the first time when they come here, rather than having an expectation of having just specific dishes. I mean, very often I ask this question to a lot of people. I'll say, I'm going to take you to a new Chinese restaurant. What are you going to have? And very often, most people already know what they're going to have before they walk in. Whereas if I ask the same question and said it was a French restaurant, they would say, it depends on what's on the menu.
Exactly.
So one of our aims is to get into that position where when somebody comes here, they will say to themselves, depends on what's on the menu. If we can achieve that, that's a dream.
I think it's a dream you're realizing very well, because I had some amazing food here tonight. I'm going to talk about those dishes with your chef when we talk to him. I wanted to ask you, what is the piece that you have not put in place yet?
I think it would be reducing the menu further and further to specialties which are absolutely unique to us. At the moment, I would say that there would be perhaps a third of the menu which are dishes which you would recognize, like crispy duck, Peking duck, and there's no reason why those dishes shouldn't stay. I suppose the ideal situation for me would be to have a menu which is entirely of specialties. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you want to reach that end. It's about the progress you make as you go along. It's a cliche of it's about the journey, not the final result.
Yeah, right.
You know, and during that journey, you end up with perhaps refining the existing dishes or altering them in a little way. For example, one of the most commonly available dishes is sweet and sour pork. We have that on our menu. But our recipe is a little bit fuller in flavor. It's a little bit spicier. So it's little changes to well-known favorites. So in many ways, when we have customers coming in, you have a choice of either trying to get them to buy a dish or order a dish which is completely unfamiliar and looks very adventurous, or sometimes to look at the menu and order something which looks familiar in terms of name, but when they try it, it's a completely new take on the dish.
You're talking about this suddenly launched a thought in my head. which is like, okay, your idea is you're going to a Chinese restaurant and you're going to order this, that, and the other because you already know about this. Your restaurant is not like that. Your restaurant is breaking the barrier so that when you come here, you're thinking of certain kinds of flavorings, fine dining, and it doesn't have anything to do with these Chinese restaurants that have endless lists of traditional foods, supposedly traditional. Most of them are actually not. They're adulterated. So, I mean, I think you're really making new ways in Chinese-influenced dining in this country. Well, we're going to be talking next, Bernard, to your... Bernard.
Oh, I did it. Bernard is fine.
To your chef, who has to have a lot to contribute to your really deserved Michelin star, a real honor. And thank you for talking to us, and we'll talk next to your chef.
Thank you.
Now, we've kidnapped our chef from the kitchen, and he's going to talk to us about what he thinks about cooking, the foods he likes, and what we had to eat tonight. Alex Chow, welcome to On the Menu.
Nice to meet you, yeah.
Okay. Your thought. You're going to be stingy about them. I want you to tell me, what do you really think about cooking, and what kinds of dishes do you like?
Cooking is a part of my life. I like eat and...
You don't look like you eat too much.
Because for since I'm young, the time I like my mama flavor. When I step in 18 years old, when I leave to school, I step into the kitchen. Until now, around 23 years, then this year we get the Michelin star for the restaurant. Yeah.
Oh, congratulations to you.
Thank you very much. And
aren't you thrilled?
And seeing 23 years is a very big achievement for me. And it's very, very great for the restaurant, for myself individually, and as well the whole team.
Now, where were you born?
I born in Malaysia, state from Kuala Lumpur.
And you started cooking at what age?
It's around 15 years old. I'm still at schooling when as a part-timer, as a kitchen helper that time. That time I feel that quite interesting because I see quite a lot of the chef, they how to hold a knife and hold a wok with a high-pressure stove, very strong fire, as normally they use in a Chinese kitchen.
I mean, you've done wonders with this restaurant. You have a very good boss, though, right?
We have to be real careful.
No, I mean, like this menu, how do you describe what kinds of food you cook here?
The root is still the Chinese region cuisine, but I influence the West and East combination as well as to balance up the flavor. In Singapore, I'm doing the modern Chinese cuisine. But my boss Bernard, they bring me over here and give me a good opportunity to establish my Greenland cuisine in London. I have to balance the old traditional Chinese dish as well the. As I'm doing in Singapore, a bit of the new modern to balance up.
But what makes it modern? What is modern? Lighter.
Baking example, we have a dish in our menu, gingdang. It's a very traditional dish seen a few hundred years ago. But I feel that the frog is such a great ingredient, and the flavor, I'm quite. Interesting. That's why our menu is peking duck in two course. First pass, peking duck, we serve with the skin as the first course, the peking duck skin with the layer of the pink the pinker skin, topped with the five frog for the first course. Then after that, we serve the second course, the traditional way. The meat wrapped with the pancake. It's the hoisin sauce.
What is the one thing you would rather eat rather than any other thing in the world? Your favorite, absolute favorite food to eat?
My favorite is I prefer the seafood rather than the red meat.
Okay.
Yeah, because
you like shrimps? You like abalone? Which
yes.
one? Soft shell crabs?
Especially I like the live item, like the live fish. We can really taste the freshness and the texture of the fish. Because in the Chinese cuisine, especially in the Cantonese, we need to the texture of the steaming, the cooking or fry, steaming, deep fry, the texture,
we had
the technique of the cooking.
We had wonderful fish tonight. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you for a compliment.
Thank you for talking to us. Have fun.
Well, it's okay. But,
okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
If you've been listening to On the Menu for the last few months, you probably remember that we've been debating interesting issue, pairing beverages with spicy foods. Spicy foods from Asia, spicy food from the rest of the world. So we're in London now, and we're at a Chinese restaurant called Kai, where you probably already know that because we've talked to a couple of people from here. But we have Michael Jenny as our next captive to talk about the beverages that he chose for us to have with our food this evening and the beverage choices that he would think are the right ones to pair with spicy Asian foods. Michael, first of all, welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you very much.
And we were going to talk wine, and then you said, no, we can't just talk about wine. We have to talk beverage. So let's make that a starting point.
Okay. When you're pairing drinks or wine with Asian food, it really depends on the mood and on the occasion. If you're feeling adventurous, the options are almost limitless. You can pair drinks from different beers, ales, porters, wine, even white spirits go very well with.
Now, do white spirits again for those people who are not familiar with the language of the trade.
Of course, different types of vodka. You have different fruit spirits as well as aquavit when served at cold temperatures from a freezer. Actually cleanse the palate very nicely, and the flavors in the spirit really shine.
But when you were approaching us to serve wines with our dinner tonight, you said, Mr. Haig, we're going to do it the wrong way around. We're going to serve you a red wine first and then a white wine. Explain that.
Yeah, it's like I said in the beginning, it depends on the mood and on the occasion. Sometimes it might be inappropriate to sort of break these classical rules. But so long as you're adventurous and you're welcome or you're open to try new things, it's just about finding the right wine to go with the right food. And in the food that you had, particularly because of the white truffle sauce in the second course, I opted to serve a very rich 2005 Burgundy and then follow that on with a white.
So we had a red. We had a red first, but it was a big French red.
Or a bigger style, very ripe
bigger
vintage
style.
Of Burgundy, okay. Followed by a white wine, which maybe the more classically sort of accustomed people are probably cringing. How can you do that?
But the answer is you have to throw away these preconceptions in order to make it work.
That's right. It's like what you said. It's more about enjoying the food and enjoying the wine.
Now, do you have some particularly unusual pairings that you think work well?
Vodka is quite an unusual pairing. Many people aren't sort of used to having vodka with their meal. So that is quite unusual.
We had someone the other day who said Grüner Veltliner from Austria seemed to be a particularly good pairing. Is that one you like?
Yes, Grüner Veltliner tends to be paired with Asian foods a lot of the time. It's quite similar to the Alsatian varietals like Riesling and Gewürztraminer, quite aromatic with good acidity. And it depends really on the food. It's a matter of experimentation. It's quite difficult to really stereotype and put wines into general categories and say, for example, Grüner Veltliner works with all spicy foods because sometimes it won't.
So if you had advice for someone who was coming to Kai for the first time or was coming to a restaurant like Kai, how would you guide them?
My advice would be to speak to the person who handles the wine list, speak to the sommelier if there is one, and ask for their suggestions. Tell them the style of wine that you like, the budget per bottle that you would like to spend, and really put yourself in their hands. Let them find the wine.
And what you can do is you can assume that a good sommelier will already know what the food version of the pairing is going to be.
Well, that's an important part of the job of a sommelier, which people tend to overlook. It's also tasting the food.
Now, Bernard was telling us that when you taste wines, you have sauces on the table at the same time.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
That's something actually I was introduced to here at CHI, is a new approach, which I think works very well. Like I said, what we found is certain categories of wine I had always thought would work, and by actually tasting them with the sauces, we've come across wines which didn't work, and we've also come across the opposite, wines which we thought couldn't possibly work, but actually go very well with the food.
So you wouldn't necessarily taste the entire dish, but you would taste the sauce that was a key ingredient in the dish.
The sauces that we normally use are a spicy black bean sauce,
okay,
a soya sauce with chili, ginger, and garlic,
okay,
and a sweet and sour sauce.
So you could put a set of those on the table and then surround wines with them, and then you taste them together.
We taste the wine first on its own, and then we taste the wine with each individual sauce. What we found, actually, the other day when we were doing a sake tasting, is that not only is sake very friendly with our food, but the sake has a very nice sort of influence on the food itself. So you taste the sake, and then you taste the sauce. And then when you actually go back to the sauce after tasting the sake again, this flavor of the sauce changes. And that's something which food and wine matching is all about.
So this is something to spot, listeners, whenever you're heading for a Chinese restaurant or an Asian restaurant generally. But if you come to CHI, you can be sure that Michael, Jenny, and Bernard will take really good care of you. And Michael, thank you so much for talking to us and for pairing the wines with us this evening.
Well, we certainly had a wonderful, wonderful time. And if anybody doubts it, they can check out our website under OTM and Pictures. We have a photograph of 5 epic campers.
Actually, I don't think I put it up there yet. But there will be a picture of 5 epic campers.
Exactly.
when the webmaster gets his work done. But in the meantime, you'll just have to dream about what it was like.
It's time now to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Here we are again. We certainly had an exotic adventure this year in London,
we had known about high-style Chinese and Indian dining in London, and we had explored the Indian one just a little bit a few years ago. This year we had the opportunity to catch up with someone whose achievements almost redefine the recognition of Indian cuisine. So let's just listen to what he had to say to us.
Growing up in the United Kingdom, as I did, Indian food has been a part of my eating pattern for more than 60 years now, but recently it's changed. Indian cuisine used to be known for being wholesome and spicy and also inexpensive, important to us as a student and all the other times of our life when we ate out a lot. But it's changed a lot, and one of the people who's been instrumental in that change here in London is Vineet Bhatia, who came here in 1993 after an interesting history of not wanting to be in the restaurant business but wanting to be something else, and set about changing the perception of Indian cuisine. Vineet, tell us about that.
I grew up in Bombay, and as a child I loved aircraft because we used to live near the airport, and I used to go to the airport to go to my school. So I had a big fascination. Okay, so I grew up in Bombay near the airport, and I used to pass through the airport to go to school, and I loved aircraft and engines, and it was a real desire to be a pilot. Unfortunately, could not get through to pilot school, and I ended up in hotel school. And that really changed my whole life.
Now you said you were vertically challenged, and that was the reason you didn't make pilot school.
I could not make pilot school because my leg length was short.
There you go.
And it was such a shame. But I got very close to actually being a pilot. I'm finally married a pilot's daughter, and I now consult for British Airways on first class. So I do travel a lot.
There we go. So well, the dining public is very fortunate. But anyway, back to the theme of our story about the improvement of the fine quality of Indian cuisine.
It has changed a lot. When I came here in 93, I was actually quite surprised and amazed by the cuisine being offered here in this country. It was quite embarrassing for a trained chef to come and work here because the quality was so poor. It was considered to be a curry on a Friday night after 6 pints of lager and loads of papadums and break a few glasses. And that's one reason why I hate the word curry, because it's a very bastardized term for Indian food.
Now, there were some people like Chutney Mary and Variswamy who were doing finer quality. Did you think they weren't as good as they ought to be?
No, they were good. I'm not saying that they were bad. They were good. But there were very few of them doing that. And there was not enough exposure being given to Indian food. what it should have deserved. So I got about setting trying to change the whole dining out scenario in a small way by providing them a breath of fresh air with some classical dishes and food cooked with a lot of care and passion.
Now, you established a real landmark in a restaurant you were involved in called Zaika. Tell us about that.
I opened Zaika in 1999 with two investors, and I was with them for 5 years. And those 5 years were absolutely amazing because as a restaurant, there's so much we achieved. I was the first Indian chef restaurateur to have got a star in 2001, the Michelin. Now, Michelin is like getting an Oscar award for a chef, and that really made history then. And it had a lot of press awareness being done regarding Indian food. So it did do quite well. But unfortunately, the partnership never really materialized.
Yeah, but that didn't stop you. So you started all over again.
I did.
And you have a Michelin star all over again.
Yes. In 1999 to 2004, I was Zaika. And finally, where I couldn't manage to sustain, I left and put my house collateral to the bank to raise funds to open Rasoi with my wife. Rasoi means a kitchen. So it's my kitchen there. And within the year and a half of opening, we got a star. And that was a big pat on the back again for me and my team. And it has done extremely very well. And in 2008, in Jan, we opened our second restaurant in London called Urban Turban.
Which is where we're sitting right now.
Which is where you are right now. And this offers Indian tapas food in a very casual and friendly atmosphere. But again, very price sensitive. It's more for a quick meal in a way, but good quality.
Now what makes the Indian cuisine that you do different from the cuisine that's more popular but you say really is low level?
Yeah. What we have is we have a lot of luxury items on our menu, especially in Rasoi, which is the top-end dining. The food is very carefully crafted and presented and prepared. And for me, it is very important that food is very visual. But that's the first thing you look at is the food. And that has to have a wow factor. And when you have a great quality product, like, say, a lobster or a beautiful piece of lamb, you don't do much to it. Unfortunately, most restaurants around the world, Indian restaurants in specifications, they add a lot of masalas into the food. And that really distorts the flavor of the protein. We try and get the flavor of the protein out by adding a few spices and also incorporating flavors into it.
So you've got a sort of a palette of spices.
Yes.
And a palette of other ingredients.
Yes, you have a different set of spices and products to use, but it's the way you blend them together is very important. You won't find oil floating onto my plates, or you won't find very strong flavors coming out from dishes, because that just kills your palate. There has to be a subtle blend of flavors and combinations.
Now, how did you master this and other people haven't done that?
Oh, gosh. Oh, I think it's just my strong training I've had at Oberoi's, which was very much like the military style. I had 3 years to train at the Oberoi's, which was very, very focused on food and very, very focused on quality. And that's where I learned the art to actually create dishes out of the products you have in your fridge. And that had led to me experimenting all the while. I as a child, never wanted to be a sheep and follow a set trend. I wanted to be different from day one. And I think that when I went to the hotel school or when I went into the food cooking as such, I could actually see myself utilizing the talent, and that really has benefited me in the past so many years.
Now, Rasoi, you said means kitchen.
Rasoi means the kitchen.
Now, can you take us through perhaps a couple of items that are on the Rasoi menu and explain them in terms of what makes them unusual?
Sure. The first example is a samosa. Now, everybody thinks of samosa as being a savory samosa, filled with potatoes and peas or with lamb. The samosas in Rasoi are made with chocolate, which is, again, very, very unusual. You don't associate chocolate with Indian food. But believe me, it's a very, very popular thing back in India. And our samosas are filled with paneer, which is fresh Indian cheese, roasted almonds, and dark chocolate and white chocolate. But the chocolate is Valerona, the best you can probably buy in Europe. Now, the art is blending chocolate into a pastry, and when you fry it, it doesn't ooze out. So that's a different take. It takes you a step ahead of what normal people do. The second thing is a tandoori chicken. Classically, around the world, tandoori chicken is red in color. It's cooked on the bone and it's served in the salad, and that is it.
And it comes out red because of the spice that you put on it.
There's a chili powder in that, which gives red color. But my tandoori chicken in Rasoi is not red, it's black, just like my hair.
No, you're going to go and explain why, I'm sure.
Yes, I'll tell you why you can do it. You get the black color because of squid ink. So you incorporate the squid ink into the marinade to color the dish. But when you taste it, the flavors are all very much Indian. But if we take it a step further, we slit the chicken and we stuff it with the tomato chutney. And when it's cooked, we garnish the whole chicken breast with gold leaf. And it's 23 karat pure gold leaf. And that's served on a bed of chili rice and some lentils. So what you get is beyond expectations.
Now, you have to. After that, you have to do another item after that, please.
Okay, sure. Tandoori salmon. Now, salmon is such a smoked salmon, a very classic Scottish dish. I mean, I put that, many people are laughing, oh, salmon is Scottish and it is slices of smoked salmon. No, it is not, my dear. It is chunks of fresh Scottish salmon which are into a marinade of mustard, spices and dill. And we smoke the salmon. Now, it's not smoked with the wood chips or with sawdust. It is smoked with charcoal. You burn the charcoal till they're live red hot. And in that, you incorporate green cardamom and cloves. And you add a little bit of clarified butter. And when the smoke starts coming out from the charcoal, you cover the whole dish with a foil and you leave it for 8 hours. What you get after that is an intensely flared Indian tandoori piece of fish, but flavored with charcoal and spices.
So you would say my food is classical Indian, mm-hmm. but you do that with your tongue in your cheek just a little bit,
I think. It does. I think my food is very much evolved Indian. I don't say it's a fusion at all because it's not a fusion. I don't do Italian food with Indian spices, or I don't do a sushi with Indian spices. I do Indian food with Indian spices. What I do is I take the best protein you can buy in the industry or from the market, and I give it my touch, which is spices and flavors and colors.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, let's go over the details. Raswa is in Chelsea. Rasoi is in Chelsea, but go on and explain where it is. And you have a website there, I think.
Yes, it is rasoirestaurant.co.uk, and it is based in Chelsea. In London, there are two addresses everybody must know when they come. One is 10 Downing Street, where the Prime Minister stays, and the second one is 10 Lincoln Street, where Rasoi is.
Okay.
It's the best form to remember Rasoi.
Well, there you go, and it's after another great government leader, so why not?
Why not? Exactly.
And it's just off the King's Road, I'm guessing.
Yes, Chelsea. It is in off the King's Road behind Sloane Square, so if you are actually shopping around the area, popping for a little light lunch. But Rasoi is an old Chelsea townhouse, and we have a closed-door policy. The doors are actually shut all during the service, and you ring the bell to get inside. And the reason why I had that was because when we opened up 5 years back in Chelsea, we were walking into a few shops, quite a few boutique shops down Sloane Avenue. And to get inside, you had to have an appointment or you knock on the door to get in. And I just loved the idea of going inside. But translating that into a restaurant was a very difficult proposal at that stage. So we said we'll have that done. So you ring the bell and you get inside. But when you get inside, it is so calm and relaxing. And you actually spend 3 to 3.5 hours in just pure pleasure and indulgence.
And if you find yourself in Notting Hill or Westbourne Grove or Ladbroke Grove or nearby, the other place to go is where we're sitting right now, which is Urban Turban, mm-hmm. where the food experience is the environment is livelier.
Yes. It's somewhat of a fun place. It's a trendy area in Notting Hill, and we wanted to add something which was quite casual. We had one which was a super expensive restaurant, and we wanted our second one which was a bit of diffusion, like a little baby, where you can go and have great quality food, but again at a good price, nothing very expensive.
Well, we were five for lunch today. We had five tapas, mm-hmm. and we had five main courses, and we really enjoyed them all. And Vineet, we thank you so much for joining us on the menu. Now, there's also a separate website for this restaurant, I believe.
Yes, it is urbanturban.uk.co.
Now, watch that one. Rasoi was co.uk.
This is the other one.
Urban Turban is...
It's the other way around because we could not get registered here.
Yeah, it's uk.com.
Yes.
Which is something we're going to start seeing almost for the first time. In fact, I got it wrong the first time because I knew it was .co.uk.
Yes.
And this is not, it's .uk.
No, we could not do it because we had domain problems to register the name. We had to get around that.
Well, Vineet, thank you so much for joining us at On the Menu, and we wish you continued success, and maybe you'll be the first Indian restaurateur to get 2 Michelin stars. How about that?
Well, you never know. Life is still quite young, have a long way to go. We have 2 already in London, and the second star is in the thought process. But we're also going very majorly overseas with our projects. We have altogether 12 restaurants.
Oh, okay.
We consult and we advise, and we constantly do food promotions. I was in St. Moritz just this last week for the Gourmet Food Festival, and it has been absolutely amazing.
So the name Vineet, Bhatia, it should be on your radar screen. Watch this man. He's been places and he's going places. Vineet, once again, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Well, they say time flies when you're having fun, and that was certainly true of this week's program, which has just flown by. It's hard to imagine that the hour is up, and we have more on London, we promise, in the next 2 or 3 weeks, at least one more complete program and another half a program on top of that as well. So be sure to be tuning in next week and the weeks after, and we'll see you again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.